Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at wliw.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is also archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed via podcast on Audio Boom and iTunes. Well, the U.S. Open Tennis Championship, the final weekend, the women's final on Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern, the men's final Sunday, 4 p.m. Eastern. And let's start with the women. The women's draw has been wide open. And at the time of this taping, the women's semifinal had just been set, featuring top seed Iga Swiatek against Erna Sabalenka and Caroline Garcia against Ons Jabeur. A new face, so to speak, here at the U.S. Open will be celebrated as the women's champion come Sunday. And we've been seeing a changing the guard in the last year as Serena dealt with injuries, other players, top players as well, dealing with injuries, really haven't been able to play too much. Ons Jabeur, the fifth seed, is the one who beat Ayla Tomjanovic in straight sets in the quarters. And she's looked so impressive all week long. All of them have, really. It will be interesting to see who prevails. More on Tomjanovic, who was beaten, in a second. But at the time of this taping, Swiatek, the top seed from Poland, beat Jessica Pegula of the U.S. to move into the women's semifinals. Pegula was the last American woman left in the draw. In the men's draw, Francis Tiafoe, he became the first American man to reach the U.S. Open semifinals since Andy Roddick back in 2006 when he beat Andrei Rublev of Russia in straight sets. This was after 24-year-old Tiafoe from Maryland eliminated Rafael Nadal. Early exit from Nadal, who's been suffering with a number of injuries, including a major abdominal injury that he suffered at Wimbledon. But Nadal would never ever talk about that. He gave so much credit to Tiafoe after the match, and Tiafoe really deserves all the accolades. He's been playing great tennis. Andy Roddick was the last man from the U.S. to win any Grand Slam singles championship, taking the 2003 U.S. Open, and talk about a drought. 74 straight majors have been played since Roddick won in 2003, which is the longest major title drought the U.S. men have had in tennis history. Tiafoe's first Grand Slam semifinal will have been played Friday evening against third seed Carlos Alcaraz, who beat the 11th seed Jannik Sinner in five sets in a quarterfinal match that finished at 2:50 in the morning and set a record for the latest ever U.S. Open match. It lasted 5 hours and 15 minutes, the second longest U.S. Open match ever. It certainly has been a very compelling U.S. Open, and it was a lot of fun to watch Serena Williams, her last U.S. Open, as she says she's evolving away from the game. She lost in three sets in the third round to Ayla Tomjanovic, and that was such a match. It was so hard fought by both players, and I really have to hand it to Tomjanovic, the 29-year-old Aussie by way of Croatia, who handled the crowd just heavily favoring Serena, obviously. Tomjanovic was just so gracious and so classy. And she spoke so beautifully about Serena, her hero, afterwards. Now, Serena did not thank Tomjanovic at all after the match, which everybody noticed. Not a classy move. It really was all about Serena. And yes, she's had an incredible career, 23 major singles titles, and a resume that goes on forever. But Margaret Court, who holds this record with 24 major titles, she had some stern words for Serena recently, telling the Daily Telegraph in Great Britain that Serena, she's admired her as a player, but she doesn't think Serena has ever admired her. Margaret Court said she's become a persona non grata in the tennis world because of her Christian beliefs, which led her to oppose same-sex marriage when it was proposed in Australia. Margaret Court said Serena also has played 7 years more than she did. Court said she finished in her early 30s. People forget that I took 2 years out. She first retired then when she was 25, thinking she would never return to tennis. A lot of people in the tennis circles have come down hard on Margaret Court, I think. But you cannot take her 24 major singles titles away from her. And I think Margaret Court deserves more credit. Either way, it is an end of an era. Serena with 23 Grand Slam titles, Rafael Nadal, 22, Novak Djokovic, they're all still going strong. Nadal, Djokovic, hopefully strong, if they can get through the injuries, Nadal and Djokovic, I can't believe he's not playing. That's a whole other story. But he is still going strong. Roger Federer with 20 Grand Slam major titles. Hopefully Roger can make a farewell tour. Their dominance on longevity, we may never see anything like it again. It's just been thrilling to be a tennis fan in this day and age. All right, all season long, the talk has been in golf about the Saudi-funded LIV Golf, wooing PGA Tour players over to play in the LIV Golf events for megabucks. And we've been talking about this for a long time, unfortunately. It's been very distracting. But this morning, you will hear my conversation on this topic with veteran golf writer Bob Herrick, CBS Sports on-course reporter Dottie Pepper, and CBS golf commentator Frank Nabilo. So I hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. Joining me is veteran golf writer Bob Herrick, SI Golf, Morning Read. I return appearance for Bob Herrick this morning. How are you, Bob? Good morning.
I'm well. Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us again. We had so much fun with you last week and so much to continue to talk about. My goodness, last Sunday when you and I were talking, who would have thought Rory McIlroy would have rallied back from a six-shot deficit and beat Scottie Scheffler? That was some win for Rory.
It really was. And, you know, Rory had buried the last two holes of the third round, which he had to play Sunday morning. And you thought, okay, now he's got him, given himself a chance. But Scottie Scheffler played his last six and four under to give himself a six-shot lead. And that was the deficit Rory faced at the beginning of the week, you know, due to the format at the Tour Championship. And you would have thought it was a little deflating. It's like, okay, he cut into it, and now it's the same as it was starting the week. But, so it was a bit of a surprise. I mean, not that Rory could overtake him. Certainly it was possible, but, you know, Scottie kind of gave him the opening early. You know, that lead was gone six holes in, and that was a bit of a surprise that Scheffler let that happen. It is unfortunate for him because he had such a great year, and you know, I don't think anybody had an issue with him being the FedEx Cup champion, but Rory's the one who got it done in the format, and it was a heck of a win for him.
I mean, Scottie took it pretty well. You know, privately, who knows how he's dealing with it, but Rory, I just think it, you know, was the most appropriate way for the season to end, right? He's just loving his leadership role with the players, it seems like. But I don't know how you can spend so much energy off the course doing what he's doing in his role with the players and, you know, helping the PGA Tour and all these modifications and being kind of like the lead spokesman against LIV Golf. And then focus on the golf course. I mean, that takes a special talent, I think.
There's no doubt it could be really distracting. I mean, you know, he was part of that big meeting at the BMW. There was obviously a board meeting of some sort or a conference call the week of Atlanta, the week of the Tour Championship leading into it before Jay Monahan made those announcements. And, you know, it's distracting. It's time consuming. You know, it takes away from working on your game, you know, and he kind of talked about that a little bit. And, you know, he said, look, I just had to put it out of my mind when it came to playing golf, but yet easier said than done, I think. And yet he did it, you know, the week of the Canadian Open, that he won, with, you know, Justin Thomas was in the mix there, Tony Finau. You know, that was the weekend of the first LIV event. And he, you know, there was clearly some motivation for him that he acknowledged. So, you know, this has brought out his best. And, you know, And he's playing next week. You know, the PGA Tour season's done, but the DP World Tour season continues, and he's playing their signature event, the BMW PGA. So we're going to see some more of Rory here over the next few weeks.
And he did say he wasn't looking forward to running into the LIV golfers who are playing in that event, right? So we could see and hear more fireworks for sure in that tournament. And I wanted to talk about Cam Smith because I so enjoy watching Cam Smith play, but very disappointed he jumped over to LIV Golf. You would think a great player like that, and really in his prime, maybe not even in his prime yet, you would think he'd want to play with the top players in the game, Bob, which I believe are still on the PGA Tour, right? I mean, I'm not surprised because we've been hearing the rumors, but what are your thoughts about Cam Smith jumping over to LIV Golf?
Yeah, I mean, you know, now you've got the highest ranked guy to go, and obviously someone who had great success this year. You know, that is a huge get for LIV, and just because of what he's accomplished. You know, and given the situation, he's not going to defend his Players' Championship title, so that's awkward. And then, you know, obviously he won the Open. He's the most recent major winner. He's going to be the most recent major winner until the Masters. You know, so that will be something they can tout for the next 7-8 months. And, you know, I'm assuming that I probably shouldn't assume, but I would think that the Masters isn't going to mess with guys who have already qualified under the existing criteria. So, you know, the next time we're going to see Cam Smith against Rory McIlroy, so to speak, is at the Masters. You know, and that's the really sad thing about this whole situation is, say what you want about LIV, there are some good players there who are eligible, who would be eligible for these tournaments, and we're not going to see them. So, you know, and to your point about you think you'd want to play against the best, yeah, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see how these guys fare having not played against the best. You know, look, I'm sure they're going to go play the Saudi International. They'll play some Asian Tour events where a bunch of them will play, you know, and it'll be 72 holes. So they'll have some, you know, they'll have some other seasoning besides LIV Golf, but I don't think it'll be exactly the same. And, you know, it's just kind of an odd, weird situation that we find ourselves in right now and still trying to wrap our arms around all of it, frankly.
That's true. It's just, it's sad that, you know, there's so much division now in the golf world. Well, let's move on to your exclusive interview with none other than Phil Mickelson. Congrats on getting that interview. And, you know, but he did seem more guarded than ever in answering questions. And he doesn't seem like he wants to say the wrong thing or stir up any more controversy. What's your takeaway from that interview with Phil?
Yeah, listen, I think that's a good take right there. Phil, I spoke to him Thursday night, and he clearly is measured now, much more measured. I talked to him in June before the first event, and he said then, before the first LIV event, kind of when he came out of, you know, hiding, so to speak, he said then, I've said some things I shouldn't have said. You know, I've talked about the tour in public, and I should have kept it private. And let's be honest, that's a great point. You know, I mean, because he caused himself a lot of harm by going public with some of this stuff when, you know, or he could have done it a little bit more, well, certainly a lot more strategically. You know, he could have gotten his point across without being so harsh. You know, accusing the PGA Tour of obnoxious greed, that became the headline as opposed to the actual meaning, which was he thought they had more funds to spend on the top players. And that's sort of why I wanted to talk to him, because that's what we've seen happen. You know, all of a sudden, within a short period of time, as we talked about last week, you know, the tour came up with $170 million,
sure,
roughly, to throw in the pot for next year. You know, and I think that was Phil's underlying point. And that was the main reason I was hoping to get him, because I felt like, just keeping it in the golf context, obviously there's so much more to this. You know, Phil, you know, he's been asked the question a bunch about, you know, the Saudi backing and you know, turning your back on the PGA Tour. But ultimately, the reason that LIV exists is due to some of the things that Phil and other players believed, that they could do better by these guys. And so that was the whole point of the conversation. And, you know, he more or less confirmed that. He wasn't pounding his chest. He was trying to take the high road as best he could, which was, I'm happy for the players. I'm happy that they are being listened to, that the top players are having an impact. And, you know, this is good for all golfers. You know, the ones who came over to LIV are being rewarded nicely. And now the guys who stayed on the PGA Tour are going to see a nice increase in funds and opportunities. So, but to your point, yes, he was reserved. He's careful, very measured. I'm not quite sure that he is over the shock of all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just my guess, my sort of gut feeling based on having talked to him for a good while. You know, he's not the gregarious, outgoing Phil right now, you know, and while he talks a good game, I think anybody who's human would have to, you know, have a tough time with all the criticism. You know, that he spent 30 years, you know, pretty much having a great, you know, response from fans and sponsors, what have you. And now it's pretty much, I would say, the feelings towards him are 75-25 negative. You know, a lot of negativity towards him, a lot of abuse, a lot of ill will, frankly. And I don't think that can be easy, even though he's tried his best to not let on.
Right. I mean, I looked at the leaderboard from the event up in Boston, and he's way down in, 40-something and plus three. I mean, it just doesn't seem like he's even motivated to play good golf. I don't know. He's just, it just doesn't seem like his golf right now is like his major priority. But do you think he will ever be able to regain that likability factor? I mean, you're talking about somebody, as you said, who was loved, who was at the top of the world after winning the PGA Championship, you know, at the age of 50. I mean, he lost so many fans with the way things went down this past year. Do you think he can ever regain that popularity?
I don't think he'll ever get back to the level that he was. You know, yesterday was, I think it was only his third subpar score since he'd come back. You know, he's had three subpar scores in LIV events. He's played, you know, he played two rounds at the U.S. Open and four at the Open and didn't break par.
Right, he was, I think he shot a minus one yesterday and a 74 on the first day, so.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's only, so that's 69. And that's, you know, he's not gone low. Now, I asked him about his game, and he said he's been working hard on it. He admitted it's been harder to return to top form than he thought. He said, I'm playing better at home than I'm showing. I need to start showing some scoring. And yet, you know, it really hasn't happened. Like you said, I don't think he's even in the top 40. He's been finishing, you know, way down in these events, you know, way behind. And, you know, I don't know how you regain your popularity. I don't know how you do it. What's going to be the stage? You know, he's in all the majors next year. But you know, he's 52 years old, and we're asking him to be competitive when it's, even without all of this, it would have been hard to be competitive in the majors. You know, and, you know, I had heard behind the scenes that he made a significant donation to the first tee in San Diego. but he kind of kept it under wraps. And I'm sort of thinking, why not talk about that, or why not, you know, announce that or what have you? I mean, he needs to show some positives from this. You know, I think all these players could, if they, it's not going to convince everybody, but if they showed some ability to use some of that money for some good, you know, that would be a big deal. So again, how do you regain that popularity? I'm not sure that you do.
And he believes that because he is a lifelong member of the PGA Tour, that he should be able to, you know, still play in PGA Tour events, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, of all the live guys, I actually think he had a point there to a degree. You know, listen, the tour's regulations are very clear. You have to get permission to play in an outside event, and they weren't granting permission for these events. So if you just take it at face value, he's in violation. Okay, so you got to put that part aside. His view is that he could easily maintain his membership by playing in X number of PGA Tour events that he cherry picked. And his point was, is if I didn't play anything else and played those, everything would have been fine. You know, nothing would have happened. I could have played 6, 8, 10 events, and I wasn't required to play 15, and I, you know, nobody would have said anything. But because I want to go play somewhere else and do that, I'm in trouble. You know, that was sort of his take on it. And I guess it's a fair point. You know, the other guys, when they're talking about trying to play both, well, it's just not realistic that you're going to play 14 for LIV and you're going to play 15 on the tour. You know, unless they change their rules, which, you know, listen, frankly, both sides would have to do if there was going to ever be any kind of a coming together. But I mean, as it stands right now, I mean, that's just almost, you know, that's just not realistic. I mean, the only guy playing that number of events would have been like Patrick Reed. You know, most of these guys are playing in the low 20s. You know, so the idea that, okay, you're going to play 15 tour events, including all the majors, and then you're going to go play 14 of theirs, it just doesn't seem possible.
Yeah. Well, to be continued, Bob. We're up against a break, but, you know, Phil also says he believes wholeheartedly he will be at Augusta. So, hey, lots of question marks, but it makes it interesting for talk show hosts like me to talk about this. And I appreciate you coming on. Great work as always. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
My pleasure to say hello to the extraordinary Dottie Pepper, former LPGA Tour winner, two-time major winner, author, lead walking reporter for golf on CBS, and this year's Met Golf Writers Gold Tee Award recipient. Dottie, welcome to the show. Delighted to have you on.
Good morning, Ann.
Hey, it was great to visit with you this past June at the Met Golf Writers National Awards Dinner. Congrats, by the way, on the Gold Tee Award.
Well, and congratulations to you, too. That was a really special evening, and your family shared in your joy, and that was really cool to see.
Oh, yeah, they all came up. It was so great to have everybody there. But I remember hearing you say that evening that when you were growing up, you always wanted to be a sports reporter.
Well, I did. I'd be happy doing local sports, and I ended up with this gig, so I'm pretty blessed.
I love it. So when did golf enter the picture for you?
Oh, it was early. I was introduced to the game by my paternal grandmother. I was the summer that I went from being age 7 to age 8, so it was early, and I got hooked early too. But I didn't play just golf. I skied all winter, so there was, you know, I had to shut it down. Growing in upstate New York, you couldn't play all year long, so I had other things to do, but I was hooked on it pretty quickly.
I love it. Of course, being well-rounded, I think, is so important as a young athlete, but your book, Letters to a Future Champion, My Time with Mr. Pulver, What a heartwarming book. It's really about mentorship. It's about the influence Mr. Pulver had on you on and off the course. And what a lovely tribute to him and really to all mentors. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I think that was the biggest thing, was a way to say thank you to him, to his family, for still being very much a large part of my life today. And also it's jogged other people's memories and put them back in contact with people that were important in their formative parts of their life, whether it was golf or not. And some of the letters that I've gotten, handwritten letters that I've gotten from people that have purchased the book and said, thank you for just putting me back in a space where I could better communicate with somebody who did mean so much in my early part of my life, has been, that's been such a huge, huge bonus.
And it's great you save those letters.
Well, they're not in some of them are not in the best of shape now after 40 plus years, but they're there, and they're all in one place.
Now, how did you meet Mr. Pulver?
Mr. Pulver was a legend in upstate New York, founding member of the Northeastern New York PGA section, and did everything golf, from being a golf course designer to being an agronomist to building golf clubs to being a golf professional. If it was golf, he was it. And his contact back to the game as a youngster came from being a caddy, caddying for 25 to 50 cents per round. But he did a lot of his apprentice work under Seymour Dunn up in Lake Placid. So he goes back to the beginnings of golf in this area.
Right, right. Just a legend up there. And I read that 10% of the proceeds of all the books will go to Saratoga War Horse Mission to improve the physical, mental, and emotional health of veterans with post-traumatic stress. So,
yeah, it was important.
Really great
he was a World War I veteran, and it was important to have a partner as a charitable component that had some sort of a link to his early part of his life.
Sure. Well, I want to get your opinion on several top golf stories, but first we have to pay tribute to the great Joanne Carner, who shot her age. 83. She shot 83 Thursday and Friday at the U.S. Senior Women's Open in Kettering, Ohio, and she played in her last USGA championship. Unbelievable, yeah. Joanne Carner.
Pretty special. I had a contact with Joanne yesterday because Brandi Burton, who was a phenomenal Solheim Cup partner and teammate and dear friend. She had lunch with Joanne yesterday and showed Joanne the picture that I put up on social media from the Oval Office when the 94 team went to meet President Clinton. And Joanne said, "Where the heck did you get that? I don't even have that photo." So now Joanne has it. I took it out of my Dropbox and I sent it to Joanne. So good things
That's
do
awesome.
Come up from social media.
And I read where her older sister, Helen, who's 91, mm-hmm. also plays golf, but she didn't take up the game until she was 70.
How about that? Never say never.
Unbelievable. Well, let's switch to PGA Tour versus LIV Golf. And, you know, this battle between these two entities is such a shame on many levels. One being that it takes away from talking about so many other things in golf we should be focusing on. But I want to get your thoughts on what's been transpiring all season. I know you wrote an essay recently expressing your opinion in quotes. Let me just read from that for a second here. It says, you said, "The result so far, a deep divide between those loyal to what we know golf to be since its beginnings, a game of honor, of merit, of respect for those who came before us, and those who have taken the easy way out with upfront money to play exhibition golf that has no soul. None of that makes golf a better place. Instead, it reduces it to other sports that spend time in courtrooms trying to gain advantage through means other than winning on the field of play," end quote. It's just, don't you think it's just sad that the sides have been drawn and it is a deep divide, and the animosity, mm-hmm. it just seems to be getting uglier and uglier.
It does. I find it a little bit hard to believe that you actually have to have some sort of competence with legal terms in order to talk about golf today. Yesterday, two more players drop out in the case against the PGA Tour, but LIV Golf as an entity jumps in. It's crazy. And I just thought golf was above a lot of this, but maybe I maybe I have rose-colored glasses on, where it's not. But I do think the positives coming out of it are that the players, PGA Tour players, are now taking a lot more, I don't know, ownership is the right word, but they're taking a more accountable approach to their tour. It's their tour. Yes, there's a commissioner, and yes, there's a board, and there's a player advisory council, but it is the player's tour. And I think it's going to be a great thing that they do take a bigger, more active role in their tour.
And do you think, Dottie, that the PGA Tour is doing enough to keep these top stars? I mean, you can't really compete against the Saudi-funded LIV Golf Tour as far as money goes. But you know, I was just talking to Bob Herrig, and he was doing the math, and they're proposing upwards of $180 million more put into the tour for the players for next year already. That's a lot of money to come up with by 2023.
Right. No, it is. That's a lot of zeros, and zeros that you never really equate to golf. But the baseline has been shifted, and whether you think it's good or bad, it's the market shifted. My struggle is that this player impact program, as it stands now, and there are a lot of questions yet to be answered, but I don't love the fact that the PIP could influence fields in big events and then influence how you get into major championships. I think this has gotten very muddy, and it erodes the meritocracy that we all have placed on golf itself, that when you play well, you reap the rewards. And I think we got a lot of concepts fighting with each other right now that are going to take some time to wiggle their way out.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about popularity, the player impact program. So are the top 20 players who get into these elevated events going to be all based on
Google
popularity? And so, yeah,
right.
Exactly. Social media. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me.
They took social media out of the equation, but Google searches. I mean, that's how I don't understand. So are you going to hire a bot to keep your Google search going so that you get into these events? I just think that erodes the meritocracy that golf has been respected for so long.
Well, to me, when you kind of boil it down to its simplest, I guess, philosophy, it's always been about character versus greed. What's more important, playing in events that matter, you know, to one, to continue one's own legacy, or do you just take the over-the-top money and turn your back on the tour that made you rich and famous in the first place? I mean, that's, to me, bottom line. I know it's a simple way to look at it, but it's always been about character. And, you know, look, I know the PGA Tour has its flaws. Don't get me wrong, but, you know, to turn your back on the tour that made these guys rich and famous to just jump to this other tour because the money's unbelievable, it just doesn't sit well with me. But I guess if you ask, if 9 out of 10 guys would probably take the money, I mean, if they had the opportunity to, so it's unfortunate.
Well, again, I mean, it's a personal. That becomes where are your personal, where are your values? That's and I can't put my values on someone else, but I can tell you what I've seen successful people do, and people that are happy in their hearts aren't necessarily the ones that have the fattest pocketbook.
That's right. Money doesn't buy happiness or legacy. Well, you also pointed out in your essay that it would be an enormous mistake for the LPGA to agree to meeting with a group that, as you say, places so little human value on women. What are your thoughts about that?
It's even more so. And I think the decision this week for the PGA Tour to have that basically signing bonus for players who keep their cards that can be used for expenses, et cetera, really puts the LPGA in a tough position because the money's not there to do that. or even, or do it equally. Money's just not there. I think that that creates another divide that's going to have to be addressed. But I firmly believe in the foundation that the LPGA has built over 70 plus years. Those 13 women who did everything for themselves and passed along that hard work ethic and bleeding with this product, and the companies that have been so loyal to the LPGA and how it has grown, and things like the Solheim Cup that have come out of it. I think it would destroy the organization if you were to align with people who look at women in that way.
Agreed. Yeah, it's, gosh, ugly conversations, right? Ugly topics. Let's kind of shift gears. I want to talk about Dottie Pepper. So what has been the biggest adjustment for you going from playing the game to talking about the game?
In some ways, Anna, it hasn't changed at all, because early on, one of my first producers, Tommy Roy, said to me, who's at NBC, do the tour championship this morning, actually, with yesterday's delay. I want you to talk to the viewer, talk to us, tell us the way you saw golf as a player. So it really hasn't changed. I do yardages and I look at cover numbers and how much room is beyond a hole or whatever, as I did as a player. And I try to just talk about it that way with a little bit of history and homework about the players I might happen to be talking about. So I talk about it as a player. So no, it hasn't really changed that much. I don't get to make my schedule. So I go where CBS Golf goes. So I don't get to, pick as I did as a player and be able to be ready for the majors and try to work your way through an annual schedule. But it's the best schedule in golf. It's phenomenal.
You are so good at it. So it does come natural, right? If you had to work at anything, what would you say you had to work at to become the on-course reporter?
I think you have to think in quick bites, run them through a filter, and get those important things out in as few words as possible. That was great advice that I had from Judy Rankin from day one, and it's something I hear in the back of my head every day. Say as much as you can in as few words as possible.
And that's so challenging, because you don't have much time. You have to really be succinct, yet get your point across.
Yeah, your brain needs to be quick. And Anna, if I get off the air and my brain's not tired, I haven't done a very good job that day.
Give us the strangest thing that's happened to you on the golf course while you've been working as a TV commentator.
Oh, I was chased by a bear.
Oh, that's right.
At the U.S. Senior Open in 2008 at the Broadmoor, and it was legit. We had known that there was a bear on the golf course, and the comms in between and commercials were, oh, the bear is over here, or he's gone more up the hill or whatever, and I thought I knew where the bear was, and I can tell you they're really fast, because he covered a lot of ground in not very much time.
So what did you do?
Well, they told you, and I in the panic of the moment, I couldn't remember if they told us to just stand still or to run. So I did both. I stood still for a while, and then I ran. But one of the funniest things was Roger Maltby was, he's so quick, so wit, and he is a very, very good pal. In the next commercial break, so I had a red shirt on and a pair of white trousers. And he said, boy, kid, it was a bad day to wear white, wasn't it?
I just lost it. Oh, that's scary. Oh, my God. If I ever
scary.
Saw a bear, I don't know
he
what
was
I
huge.
Would have done. Oh, my gosh.
He was beautiful, but he was huge.
Well, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you. Continued success. I just
Thank
so
you.
Admire your
Thank
work.
You
and
too.
Give your dog Rupert our love, will you?
I will. He's waiting for his walk.
Ah, Dottie Pepper, thanks so much. And let's look at some of the top stories in golf And with that, I welcome in Frank Nobilo, golf commentator, CBS Sports. Good morning.
Thank you very much. I do that for a living, Ann, just like you.
I know. Isn't it fun?
It has its moments, believe me, as you very well know.
Absolutely. And as you look back at this PGA Tour season, Frank, just interested in getting your overall thoughts. We've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, I think you need a kaleidoscope, really, to look at 2021, 2022. You know, there's the obvious thing that everybody's talking about right now, which is LIV. But really, I go back to the start of the calendar year. I remember at Torrey Pines where CBS was starting the first show, and that's where we met the Netflix people. And we were led to believe it was going to be good. You know, Netflix were going to do, like, Drive to Survive on golf. But it would be great for golf. It would show people, you know, what a wonderful game it is, how good the, you know, professional golf is and all of that. And then in amongst this, you know, all the young players, the fact that we have, you know, the five biggest tournaments or the four majors all won by 20-year-olds. We had a great rookie class. And yet everybody basically moves to the big elephant in the room, which is LIV. And playing their fourth tournament this week, which I think is stating the obvious, is the huge destabilizer of what would have been a great season.
Right, exactly. I mean, it just got so distracting talking about it, but you have to, right? Because it's real now. But you know, I was talking to Bob Herrig about Rory McIlroy earlier, and for you as a former tour player, I'm sure you can appreciate the extra effort it takes to play such an active role, you know, in player policy and working with the tour to make changes. I mean, Rory embraces that role. It can't be easy to do all of that off the course. I mean, could you imagine being that involved when you played? It's pretty amazing, right?
Well, a lot of players were, and I think that's where the sort of the split in the road comes, because, you know, one of the things that's come out, I was actually, I remember back to the lawsuit, it was before the Ping lawsuit, before I was playing on the PGA Tour. I remember talking to Roger Maltby, who was on that board. I think that was back in 1989. That went on for 3 or 4 years. But there was a lot of players on that board. They split. They didn't know whether, you know, equipment should be allowed, the square groove issue, should be allowed to dominate the game. The Nicklauses, the Palmers, you know, there's been so many. Generation Woods is doing his part as well. So it's not just Rory. I think Rory has done really what should have been. You know, if Arnold Palmer was still alive, or, you know, Jack Nicklaus was still on tour, they'd be doing the exact same thing. Seve spoke up for Europe. Nick Faldo spoke up for Europe when they were in their prime. So I think it's a continuation of that. That's actually the obligation and the expectation of the best players in the game, not go behind closed doors and really sort of drive a wedge. There's a lot more ways to get the job done. But yeah, so we should be proud of that. But I also expect that from the game's best players.
Right. Good point. And you had mentioned then, as another positive story, four different guys who won the majors this year. They were all under the age of 30, right? Scottie Scheffler winning the Masters, 25. Matt Fitzpatrick winning the U.S. Open at 27. Justin Thomas, 29, winning the PGA Championship. And Cam Smith, 28, winning the Open Championship. Aside from the fact that Cam Smith just bolted for LIV Golf, I mean, it has to be good news for the PGA Tour that these young guns are you know, winning these major championships and doing so well on the PGA Tour.
Well, golf as a whole, because, you know, obviously, you know, Cam comes from Australasia, where Seb Straka's first Austrian player to win this year on the PGA Tour. So, you know, we've got a lot of players coming from various countries doing some amazing things. But you're right, youth. Zalatoris getting his first win, sadly couldn't play the last two playoff events, but winning the first one in Memphis. The story of, I think, the last sort of decade, when since Jordan Spieth, you know, Justin Thomas have come on the scene, it's the changing of the guard. You know, Tiger obviously has had he's been able to play less, but he's still been out there enough to gently pass the baton along. But it's really being picked up, and the style of play that I see with these young guys. I mean, that the rookie class of Cameron Young, Seath, Fagala, and Davis Riley, I mean, they were the three standouts. Obviously, Cameron Young, the best of those three. But they're coming through thick and fast, which makes the game appear healthy when you really go past the level that everybody's talking about. So that's the level that I look at. I'm trying to look at the next stars that are coming through. the ones that are capable of winning the biggest championships and playing the best golf. And they're coming through extremely fast, and they're coming through from a lot of different places.
Oh, absolutely. There's so much depth on the tour. It's just incredible to see. All right, so what are your thoughts, Frank, about LIV Golf and the battle going on between LIV and the PGA Tour? What are your overall thoughts about it all?
I just wish it went elsewhere. I hear a lot of the analogies, and you know, sadly, we get a lot of our news through social media, and a lot of it's not true. For example, youth, you know, when your product is on YouTube TV, you know, my mum couldn't find YouTube TV, or sorry, YouTube, not YouTube TV, but my mum couldn't find that. So you're going to morph it to a different demographic to start off with. And the insinuation is that the game is getting older or whatever. Well, that's also why golf has survived. Its demographic is extremely valuable to promoters. We don't get the ratings, stating the obvious, that NFL and the NBA and Major League Baseball get. So we have to compete in a different way. So we have a very rich demographic. So, you know, that sadly doesn't get talked about when LIV talks about its numbers and all that. And I saw, just like everybody else, you read it, you know, you see everything. You know, Greg talking about wearing shorts. You know, players can wear shorts if that's the biggest thing. But overall, you know, I think the easiest way to put it, if you've got to pay people to come to your party, then maybe it's not the best party in the street. And that's probably the easiest way. But to put it, but I just really think they should have taken the leaf out of Formula One's mold. Formula One is a business model. Bernie Ecclestone locked up all those TV rights around the world. They proved their product elsewhere, and now they have three Formula One races in America. They referred to cricket. Well, the IPL is a business model. They sold the TV rights for $6 billion. So, but once again, that wasn't just people trying to buy some of the top players and be the stabilizer. That was an organization that worked in the off season for the cricketers. So I think if you go past the first level of what you read about, you get a little bit of the truth there. And I think that's the biggest problem. You know, we're hearing players, for example, that have spoken so well for the last 5 to 10 years, and in 1 week completely changed the narrative. You know, want more time with their families and whatever. And it's a shame, because the people I liked, I've had dinner with over the years, and I think you can get caught up to where the money comes from. I mean, we live in I love the word duplicitous, because it's been used so often recently, but that's the sort of world we live in. But in the end, it's like, you know, where did you come from? I hailed in from New Zealand. I've never have forgotten that. And I think sometimes people have conveniently just pushed some things behind the door. And I think that's the saddest thing that's happened this year. I know that's a roundabout way, but I think I would stick with my best one, which is, you know, if you have to pay people to come to a party, then it's not the best party in town.
Right, right. And so much. I mean, unlimited funds. But where is the return on investment when you look at it? How do they make back any of this money?
Well, you know, I love a crystal ball. I would imagine gambling's a big thing. Also selling the teams. There's rumor that, you know, the teams were going to sell for, you know, $250 million. If there's 12 teams, that's $3 billion. You get money back there. And it's a different product. That's why I would have imagined that if the people at the helm really looked at some of those other sports, cricket, which they've talked about, and Formula One, they would start elsewhere. But you could see it was a deliberate, let's have a go in domestic America. And we're going to have a go there, which does reek of an agenda. There's golf should be spread worldwide, and they would have had a very good vehicle to do that, but instead they wanted to, you know, they want to pick a fight, and now it becomes ugly, one way or the other, and it's a turf war. But you know, I feel bad too for the European Tour, Australasian Tour. You know, it's not just the PGA Tour, but that's where the fight is at the moment. And it's just a shame, because we need more money in the game. There's no question about it. But I think the players, too, have to look at it. Really, if you want to look at pure viewership, they're not entitled to, you know, NFL money. They're not. I know they play longer. They have a longer lifespan. They will make a lot more money. Fortune magazine, you know, I think the top 50 athletes, you know, three of the top five are golfers. So golfers do extremely well in the sporting environment. So you just have to take one step back sometimes and look at the whole landscape.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not all about the money. I mean, you see Cam Smith, who's just incredibly talented, And wouldn't you think that he'd want to play with the best players in the world in meaningful competitions?
Yeah, you would. And I'd like to think in 10 years that's going to be a massive regret. 5 years. I think some of them genuinely believe, and we've already heard that from some of the players, that they never thought they would be banned from the tour, that it wouldn't hold up. And I know the lawsuit is impending. So once again, they've been sold a bill of goods. I can take a lot of cash here. I'll be able to play both anyway. Or, you know, if I'm sick of this, I'll just go back and play. Like, it's that convenient. You know, this is my girlfriend today and this is my girlfriend tomorrow. That's going to work. But it's not going to wash. And the sums of money are obscene. I thought what Harold Varner wrote was probably the most genuine thing that I've read. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for him as a guy and as a player, too. And it's sad to see players like him go as well. Cameron Smith, you're right, number two player in the world, wins the Players' Championship and the Open Championship. Yeah, that's a big loss. But it's a big loss more, in my opinion, just for golf. And you know, I know people use the word legacy. I just want the guys to compete. But, you know, if you're going to play 54 holes or go elsewhere, you know, you're not putting yourself into the best possible frame to play your best golf. He knows that. Everybody knows that. You know, Greg Norman, who's running the tour, he never approached events that way. You know, Nick Faldo, who sadly said farewell this year, I mean, he was tireless in his pursuit to be a better player tomorrow than what he was today.
Well, on a positive note, Frank, when you're saying golf should be spread across the world, right, worldwide, the winners of the five majors on the women's tour are from five different countries. So that's a good thing, right? You have Jennifer Kupcho, who won the Chevron Championship. She's American. You have Minji Lee from Australia. She won the U.S. Women's Open. You have Ji Chung from the KPMG Women's PGA from South Korea. Brooke Henderson from Canada won the Evian Championship. And Ashley Buhai won the Women's British Open from South Africa. So we'll end on a positive note. The women who won these major championships from all over the world. And so hopefully the women can continue to, you know, go strong and not have this threat of live golf, for sure.
Yeah, I know Dottie Pepper's involved in that. They have a meeting coming up. But you know, Minji Lee, my good friend Mike Clayton down in Australia, he told me about Minji years ago, as well as her brother, Minwoo Lee, who's sort of starting to make his mark. And I remember doing the first ANWR at Augusta, seeing Jennifer Kupcho win there. So, you know, it's neat to see these girls as well just turn into, you know, turn their potential into results. It's talent. The one word that comes out in 22 is talent. That's the thing. If you want to leave, that's the positive note. There's a lot of talent out there, male and female.
Absolutely. So much depth. Frank, always a pleasure. We don't have enough time, but it's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. Take care.
Have a great rest of the Labor Day weekend. My thanks to Frank Nabilo, to Dottie Pepper, and to Bob Herrick, and Mike Goodsoe in production. Have a wonderful week, everybody. Remember the great words of Winston Churchill. The pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. The optimist sees opportunity in every difficulty. Be kind, be safe. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning, right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGore.